Monday, August 3rd. This is LA Podcast. I am Scott Frazier, and I am here with Hayes Davenport. Alyssa is taking a well-deserved break, vacation, that I'm sure everybody is in need of equally at this point in time. So it's just me and Hayes today. Hayes, how are you doing?
Doing okay. We have a lot to get into this week, but I was thinking we could start by talking about last week, an interview, our second interview with a city council member, Councilmember Marquise Harris Dawson of the 8th District. And it's always confusing to me. Like, I confess to never knowing exactly how to handle those interviews, because I'm always torn between like wanting to hear as much as possible from an elected official. Like, I want to get their thoughts on record, and I do think that was valuable. But also at the same time, you do hear that they say things that you disagree with, and you wonder about the limits of pushing back. Like, you understand you only have about an hour. You want to cover as much ground as possible. So
sure,
it is like you're always just kind of playing it by ear, always, as if we've done this like so many times. The two times we've done it, we've kind of played it by ear. But what was your big takeaway from that interview or takeaways?
Well, I do think anybody who's listening to this, please go back and listen to last week's interview, because I do think that it was, I mean, getting to talk to one of the most powerful people in the city, one of the very few elected officials who has such a disproportionate amount of control over what happens to everybody else who lives in the city of Los Angeles. For the amount of power that they have, these individuals don't actually get put on record that much and don't actually speak about either their actions or their personal philosophy about what their job is and how they approach that frequently. So to me, that aspect of the interview is tremendously successful, because right or wrong, for better or worse, there were definitely things that Councilmember Harris Dawson said that first of all, that I wouldn't have expected him to say, that I found myself agreeing with. There were a lot of things he said that I didn't also agree with, but I also feel, even as an interviewer who spends a lot more time probably than the average Angeleno digging into the affairs of city council, that I personally left with a much greater understanding of who he was as a politician than I went into the interview with.
I feel like I did too. I think part of some people were not happy with how we conducted the interview, but I think that's partially a consequence of an elected official being unexpectedly upfront about both like his positions and his experience in city council and his like perspective on the whole deal. Lots of people unhappy with his perspective on our need to reopen schools and how like nobody is gonna obey distancing protocol and wearing masks. So you just kind of have to let people make those mistakes. Something I disagree. I thought we did push back on that a little bit, like maybe too gently. But I also didn't want to spend the whole interview talking about reopening protocols. I was surprised that nobody mentioned the story he told about him and Mayor Garcetti before either were in elected office, talking about Mayor Reardon's move to increase the police force to 10,000. And both of them saying to each other when they were younger, like, we got to stop this. Like, this is ridiculous. We got to stop the police force from blowing up like this. And then in his own words, they got into office and every step of the way they voted to expand the police force. That to me was like a big thing to hear. Something we have not heard, that level of like accountability and admission of having participated in and enabled the staggering increase in funding and size of the LAPD over the recent decades. And this from someone who's done a lot of great organizing work in LA. Like, he ran the Community Coalition. Mm-hmm. This is one of the groups that is now helping lead the charge to defund the LAPD. And, you know, as we talked about on the show, this is Harris Dawson is the one council member who didn't support Charter Amendment C, which was the big police union push to make the disciplinary process more favorable for police. What it sounded like to me, and what I was kind of surprised by, is he sounded like he felt trapped in a lot of ways, like trapped and like kind of resigned to a process that just is like a machine that's kind of operating without him being able to do much about it. And I understand why that was upsetting for people, someone who actually does have that much power. But he talked about how, you know, what's changed is people are calling his office now to ask why they didn't defund the police more rather than the opposite. Like, public opinion has changed.
Right.
And yeah.
I mean, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
No, sorry. I mean, like that they are just purely responsive to like the prevailing public opinion in the city. It's like, of course that's true, but it was nice to hear that acknowledged for me.
I think what was particularly either surprising or stuck with me from the interview was, you know, he made several comments, the council member did, to the effect that not necessarily that he felt trapped, like you're saying, but specifically that he felt like he could have been out earlier in his tenure as an elected official on the leading edge of the fight against the LAPD, but that, as he perceived it, if he had done so, he would have substantially narrowed the bandwidth of other things that he was working to get done in his district in South LA, would have spent all of his time fighting against a negative and substantially made up perception being spread by the LAPD against him. And that also, what I really picked up on was that his impression was, if you contrast him with the other council member that we've spoken with, Mike Bonin, I got the sense that he did not feel like he would be the recipient of a lot of the public support that Mike Bonin has gotten as a progressive council member on the West Side, obviously, who is also a white man. And it's something that I think about too, because it's a challenging notion, right? Like, Black Lives Matter is a powerful activist group now and has been out there for 8 years now, organizing mostly out of Central and South Los Angeles. And I think the tendency is there to think if a Black elected official shows up and is saying all the right things, then this progressive activist infrastructure that exists in LA would rally around them and would support them. But I'm not sure, you know, I think I at least understand why Councilmember Harris Dawson has doubts about the truth of that. I think we've seen in a lot of cases, and I think it is changing, and hopefully it is changing here, but I think we've seen a lot of cases where Black politicians don't get, first of all, you go too far out on the leading edge of something and the central apparatus of the party drops you, will turn on you really quick. Ilhan Omar is a good example of that. And then you also run the risk of, because of the existing segregation in Los Angeles is a perfect example of this, that the daily experience of the 8th District in LA, which is also something I really wanted to have Marquis Harris Dawson speak on to us, is so removed from the daily lives of an activist base. You know, I'm Black, but I live in the 13th District. I live very far from its district. And so you run the risk of not getting the media attention, which is what he kept saying, not having that cause célèbre sort of drawn to you, and then you're just out on your own and you're possibly failing in your most basic responsibilities. I at least understand it. It's disheartening, and I'm not sure that I totally see it the same way that the council member does, but I got where he was coming from.
Yeah, it would have been easy for him, I think, to come on the show and talk the way a lot of other elected officials in the city are talking and saying, I have always been part of this fight. And actually, it would have been more true for him than literally any other council member if he had said that. But he didn't. He was like open and honest about the legacy of the council and their participation in the process of enabling policing in LA. And I appreciated that. The one place that I personally wish I had pushed back a little more or said something is when he was talking about community policing, especially in light of what happened later in the week. I wish I had said, doesn't an expansion of community policing fund the police? Doesn't it expand the role of the LAPD in the city instead of diminishing it, which is what people are asking for? We didn't say anything like that and should have. Yeah.
And I think that with the, it is something that I feel like we could and should have challenged more at the time. But I do think, you know, now given the proposal that's actually been put in front, now they're saying that they are going to expand that program to other locations and increase the allocation of funding that goes to this community policing. Again, I think that it is, you know, it is beneficial to have his comments on record in such detail as he provided them. I do think that the school thing is something that I felt like was, if it had been on our radar, if it had been on my radar personally, I would have been a little bit, I guess, more prepared to respond to that. But I do think the notion of, he said, I think, basically two things. One, he said, like you mentioned earlier, Hayes, people aren't going to follow these guidelines. And secondly, not having in-person learning is tantamount to like throwing out a couple of years of a child's life. And I think that there are probably more people who feel that way, more parents who feel that way than it necessarily gets coverage in the media here. But that being said, I don't think it's a tenable solution. I don't think it's even, it's basically a non-starter to say teachers, on top of everything else that they're dealing with right now, should be tasked with redefining what it means to go to school, rebuild the entire model from the ground up. And that is the appropriate path for. This is a case where I don't think that you can really say, as the council member did, government can't and shouldn't lead, and somebody else will step in to fill that gap. So
it actually, I think, increases the need for local government to step in, because there are families with kids with like different like learning difficulties that cannot sit in front of a computer all day and take a class, especially like a group class. Like, I know parents that the fact that their kid is not physically in school means that they are not getting an education, period. And also, with so many parents working without like childcare options, I mean, the current situation is actually not tenable either. So I think what he was saying, he actually got to a reasonable idea for some parents, which is just like set up something else. Like, even if it's not like an official school thing, outdoor, send the kids to a park, like have them be in some situation where they can be some form of educated and taken care of while their parents work. Yeah. I mean, it does feel like there has to be some stepping in to make that happen. Let's talk about this new community policing initiative. This is one of the biggest things that happened this week. Big announcement by Mayor Garcetti and a bunch of council members, including Marquise Harris Dawson, essentially that they were reimagining public safety in Los Angeles. And Scott, how were they doing that?
So the plan that was announced, and as you mentioned, Mayor Garcetti was there. We had Police Chief Michael Moore, council members, including Marquise Harris-Dawson, Curran Price, and Monica Rodriguez. The plan that was announced consisted of taking the CSP program, the community policing that, according to the mayor, has been sort of like a nationally recognized model for integrating beat cops basically into the communities that they are tasked with policing. So the goal for this new expansion that has been proposed would be to take that model, which exists at, I want to say, two different locations in South LA, in South Park and in Watts, and would expand it to several other sites and basically just like pull in additional resources, including more officers. And Mayor Garcetti was quick to point out during the course of this press conference that it was not an expansion of the money that would be given to the LAPD. So a redirection of existing monies that the LAPD has access to. But that being said, it was mentioned at several points throughout the course of this presentation. Councilmember Joe Buscaino of the 15th District, the Harbor, also including the Shoestring Annex going up into Watts. The comments made by Councilmember Buscaino made it pretty clear that this is sort of a counter proposal to defunding the police. This is, he was saying, we have this model that we want to implement that we know will work, kind of saying other methods of policing have failed. Community policing will work. And also, we can't do this if you're really serious about defunding the police.
Yeah, he did suggest the need for additional funding to really make this work.
Yeah.
And this is, so what is community policing? It's the kind of thing that you see on the social media feeds of the LAPD all the time. It's you go into a neighborhood, you kick a soccer ball around with kids, you tell them that they can talk to you about their problems, you get to know, in some cases, what's going on with their home lives. I'm sure there are many positive relationships that have come out of this effort. But I think my response is the same as what a lot of groups like Black Lives Matter and other people that have been on the forefront of the movement to defund LAPD were saying, which is this is not what we were asking for at all. We are asking for services in the community. We're not asking for LAPD for armed officers to provide those services. In fact, the opposite. We are asking for unarmed social workers, mediation specialists to do this job. This is obviously, you know, I would never be one to say like social workers should not be like paid a certain amount, but cops get paid a huge amount to do this kind of work. And what's kind of striking to me is like we always talk like, you always hear people talk about like role models for young kids, especially like Black and brown kids, when it comes to like whatever rappers or athletes, that they don't have any good role models and that leads them towards violence, right, or whatever. Why are you going to provide these role models who always have a gun, who are never not right, carrying a gun? Like you, it puts, yeah, weapons on like on the belts of the role models that we're providing for kids. Like that's the stated goal. It just like that doesn't make sense to me.
I do recommend for anybody listening to this, check out Sara Suleiman from A Streets Blog had what I thought was a tremendous thread on Twitter that she put together, basically just incorporating the on the ground reporting that she's done in South LA over the course of the past several years, including some looks at the community policing model. This is, I would say, something that has not gotten that much press coverage as a whole. So there's I think, an informational deficit that needs to be closed when the LAPD is announcing CSP as the latest in, honestly, a very long line, an extended succession of attempts to redefine what policing is and how it looks in the city of LA. And Sarah's reporting does mention, you know, that there are substantial changes to the way that other LAPD outfits operate that were implemented as part of CSP. That being said, you know, it's not, I don't think that it is necessarily the wholesale top to bottom remodel that city leaders are necessarily casting it to be, particularly as CSP still exists within an operating infrastructure that includes not only those other parts of LAPD that are doing things in the same way that they've always done them, but also in an environment that involves 50 plus other enforcement agencies, including the sheriff's department, which has been a source of problems in the past.
I mean, even if it were like a comprehensive, effective transformation of the entire LAPD, what that would still mean to me is that the focus in this case, the priority, is maintaining funding levels rather than providing these services properly. That like the LAPD totally. And the LAPPL are basically saying like, you are not touching this money. So like as long as everyone gets paid the same, we'll do whatever, you know, we'll like shoot TikTok videos with these kids all day long, whatever you want to do, as long as everyone is continuing to get paid. Which in the context of a city where services are nickel and dimed in every other circumstance, yeah. Like Lhasa, like outreach, and I mean, you name it, everything gets like the absolute minimum funding level. Until it comes to like cops doing these jobs, and then there's just no question of that they have to get max dollar, and they're celebrated as heroes for doing this work. It's just to continually justify their own existence as a close to 10,000 person department where everyone makes six figures on average.
Yeah, there's never a question about ratcheting up the level of spending, and I think that this most recent proposal is clearly intended to be the block on which they can rest and try and push back against calls to reduce funding for police even further. So the core of the message that is being put out by city leaders is one of trust us. Yeah. That is what they're saying. They're saying we're going to radically revamp what policing is and looks like. And I mean, they spent a lot of time talking about how much data that they had to back up the validity of this transition to CSP. But that, I mean, it's just more of project this out into the future and assume that all of this is being done in good faith. It resets the conversation another several years. And then it's kind of like, if it doesn't work, then they're going to be like, well, of course that didn't work, but we've got this other new thing. It just is, it is a way to keep the balls in the air.
I mean, for law enforcement in LA right now, you know, there's a lot of pressure for reform or to like disband the departments altogether. You're constantly pushing back on, you're watching all these people protest against you in the streets. It's got to make you pretty thirsty. And if I were a law enforcement officer, what I would probably do is head on down to the Sassafras Saloon. Right. The Sassafras Saloon, notably also where Earwolf, my other podcast network, had its holiday party this past Christmas, was host to a party, an indoor party of first responders, is how the saloon described it. Knock LA, the independent journalism outlet, caught wind of this. They managed to get several attendees of the party on tape, saying their entire names by filming, pretending to be bouncers and filming them saying for insurance reasons they had to say their names and just say that they did not have a temperature.
Yeah.
Which they also felt comfortable just saying because, like, you know, they just want to get in the party. Like, they don't know if they have a temperature.
I want to say something about that, but I will let you finish this first.
So what Knox said was that this was a party by the sheriff's department, that the sheriff's department was throwing. Searching of the names of the attendees in the Transparent California database of people that work in the public sector, they seem to match people that work for the State Department of Corrections. So state prison guards, basically. Or LAPD officers, potentially.
But not sheriffs. Either CDCR, the correctional the prison guards, or LAPD. But evidence at least doesn't support that the sheriffs were directly involved. Obviously, it's a small sample of people who did give their names to the Knock LA journalists and to Cerise Castle from KCRW. The really wild thing about this is, well, actually, I don't even know where you start. This is what nobody is contesting, really, is that there is a bar not allowed to operate, throwing a large indoor party, not allowed. Nobody's wearing masks. There is an order about mask wearing in public, yes. Isn't there? So all of those are happening. Nobody's contesting these. And then that the party is for first responder. It is for law enforcement officials. At this time of indeterminate employment, but you basically have a big group of law enforcement officials getting together to violate laws and executive orders during the local emergency period en masse. And I want to say that if you watch those videos, that to me looks like if you thought you were going somewhere that was on the up and up, I feel like you would be a lot more suspicious about, like, the person asking you to state your name and that you didn't have a temperature on camera. Like, I feel like it would be weirder if you were going,
totally.
If I were going somewhere that was observing social distancing and, like, I knew should be open, I'd be like, why are you trying to put me on camera? That seems like, you know, you're going in somewhere that you know is illegal, and so you acknowledge that you might just have to do something shady to get in the door.
So I want to really dig into, like, conspiracy theories around this. Apparently, someone working at the bar was the one who communicated to Knock that it was a sheriff's department event. And Knock, in pretending to be bouncers, asked the attendees, are you here for the LASD party? And they said yes, which they interpreted to be basically admission that it was a sheriff's department event. What do you think it was, Scott? Do you think it was State Department of Corrections people, sheriff's department, or LAPD? Call it now.
Okay, I will call it now. I will start by saying I don't think that people saying yes to are you here for the LASD party is the smoking gun that it's made out to be, because I mean, just thinking, if you show up to an event and somebody says to you, like, oh, are you here for this thing? And it's not correct, but you obviously know what they meant, then I feel like you wouldn't even waste time correcting.
Especially
them.
If you're going into an illegal event, you're going to say, like, no, sorry, this is for the LAPD. The LA Police Department is throwing this illegal party.
And the second person who shows up in the video, you can tell that he thinks it's suspicious because he asked them the address instead of responding to
the
question.
And then they don't know what the address is, the person from Knock. And the guy's like, okay, I guess that's still cool. Here's my name.
Do it anyway. So on the record, I my overriding suspicion is that this was an LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department event.
Me too.
How about you?
I absolutely think it was LAPD. The names match officers for sure and the LAPD, but also possibly in the same division. It makes no sense that people from the State Department of Corrections would be in Hollywood for this party. There's no, I mean, like, I don't see it. What I do think is possible, and you disagree with me on this, I totally think it's possible that in booking this party, these LAPD officers said that it was a sheriff's department event. I totally believe, not only do I believe that's possible, I believe that is what happened. The departments don't really like each other. And
that's true.
You know, and I think it's likely that, it, you know, this wasn't like Chief Moore like calling and booking this event. I think it probably was just a bunch of cops are like just getting tired of drinking alone, basically. So like, I, you know, with top, the idea that top brass is like in on this, I say probably not possible, but I totally think that whoever booked it was like, yeah, it's first responders. We're the sheriff's department. Yeah. And it's so far it has worked.
Yeah. So we're recording this on Sunday. So far, the sheriff's department has responded and said that, I mean, well, what do you expect the sheriff's department to say? They more or less had their spokesperson say it was a liberal media conspiracy, right. And, you know, right. But LAPD has not been asked to comment about it whatsoever. Neither has Mayor Garcetti, notionally the person to whom the chain of command runs up. Neither has Mitch O'Farrell, who included two separate sweeps, which I found on the list that Michael Kohlhaas posts online. I mean, he just does that pretty much every day of the year, posting who is getting swept at what time. So there were two different care sweeps that were scheduled in front of the Sassafras Bar and honestly all around that block, first on the Friday a week before and then the Friday the day before the party. So it's very likely one of two things, as long as we're in the conspiracy racket. It's very likely that either the request for one of those sweeps, because this is how they generally proceed, either came from the business owner knowing that they had this party coming up and booked, or from the police that were involved in it. I mean, it's really a question to ask Mitch O'Farrell's office. You put down this address to receive care. Why? And who asked you to do that?
I'm not sure I'm there yet. I'm not positive that this, you know, they're doing sweeps. The sweeps are happening.
They are doing
regardless, sweeps. You know? So I'm not ready to affirm that these sweeps were connected to this event. And I'm not sure there's a way to, I mean, you know, if that's ever proven, that would be amazing. But it would be nice if somebody found out who was the employer of the people that are just on camera giving their names. Shouldn't be that hard for these departments. And, you know, the sheriff's department, in saying that it was fake news, liberal media, like whatever, did also say those people on camera are not employed by the sheriff's department. Like, they were pretty conclusive in that. So now I think it is worth moving on and asking who actually does employ them. Speaking of law enforcement committing crimes, we had two stories this week that would probably be the biggest stories any other week and maybe should have been this week, both within the LAPD and the Sheriff's Department, of officers, former officers or deputies coming forward and saying that there are effectively gangs operating as like organized crime syndicates within, in the case of the sheriff's department, the Compton station, which we've been hearing about these gangs for years and years now, in Compton station specifically, and in LAPD in SWAT, and what they refer to as the SWAT mafia. Do we want to talk about Compton station first?
Yeah, sure. So what we have in the case of the sheriff's department is basically the precursor to what will be a lawsuit against the county or the LA sheriff's department specifically. I actually think it is a lawsuit against the county. And that claim is one that
alleges that there is a gang of the type that we've talked about at length in numerous episodes of this podcast that operates within the sheriff's department. These gangs, some of them that are most well known, you have the Bandidos, the Jump Out Boys was an old one, the 2000 Boys, the 3000 Boys. They are functionally indistinguishable from street gangs, except for the fact that they operate under protection of the law, and they operate with law enforcement officers as their members. They have been pernicious and very hard to root out in the LA Sheriff's Department. That is, if you give credit to the claim that the Sheriff's Department is trying to root them out. Now we have a new claim that there is an executioner's gang, so-called, all tattooed with a skull, wearing a Nazi helmet, and
I will say that's not to me, flames. It's not conclusive. This is as much as I'm willing to give them. To me, not conclusive that it is a Nazi helmet. The lawsuit does allege Nazi imagery. Yeah, in the tattoos, but the one tattoo we have seen from a deputy at Compton Station, it could be. An American skeleton soldier carrying an AK-47.
True. Okay. That is a fair point. Nazi imagery alleged at this point. And the claims go so far as to say that every aspect of life in Compton Station is run by this gang. The LA Times says, another story by Aline Chekmadian and Maya Lau, stating that the Compton Station is, quote, dominated by the executioners.
And they don't they don't let black deputies or female deputies into this gang. And I will say, I'll come forward and say it right now. It's time to let black deputies and women into the sheriff's gangs. This has gone on long enough. It's time to diversify these gangs.
Yes. We need to just buy female sheriff's deputies copies of Lean In, and then we'll see changes in Compton. Compton Station is where the deputies who pulled the trigger and killed Andres Guardado were deployed out of. This has been the site of numerous protests since that event, which was, of course, in June this summer. But the revelation that, insofar as it is a revelation, that the new knowledge that we have about the operating structure of this department, and that it might be so thoroughly overrun with a gang structure that it can determine who gets promoted, who stays at the station, things like that, encouraging potentially acts of violence committed more or less at random against the populace, is only more troubling given the fact that we know Sheriff Alex Villanueva has dragged his feet on the investigation of the death of Guardado and has actively sought to malign the investigation in the press, saying that the release of the coroner's details has made it harder or possibly unlikely for them to be able to deliver an impartial verdict on what happened, in that kind of pre-signaling that he is not going to take action against the deputies involved.
Similar to how he's taken action so far in the investigation of these gangs. I mean, in a lot of cases, you have these inspector generals of these law enforcement departments, like for the LAPD usually. They kind of stay quiet about these investigations and, for the most part, kind of toe the party line for law enforcement. Not in this case. The inspector general for the county investigating these gangs says outright that Sheriff Villanueva has made these investigations impossible. He has not made deputies come forward. They have not had to get on record about it. The Bandidos gang specifically, which Villanueva has been accused of being a member of, IG is saying, he absolutely, I think he used the words cover up about this investigation. This is the IG talking about the sheriff who is in charge of this operation. For LA,
When do you think that we're going to get the next round of federal indictments in the sheriff's department?
The next, I mean, like, unfortunately, I think it's going to...
Because it's only been, what, like 5-6 years since the last round?
I worry that, like, the product of this time period where an openly adversary... Like, the reason this is happening is because the sheriff is so stupid and is not just doing what all the other sheriffs have done, right, which is pretending to be like a new kind of law enforcement officer and like not like picking fights with the people that like, you know, yep, like trying to embarrass and humiliate the people who supervise you. That's what Villanueva has done. So now they're coming down on him. I worry that we're going to get this kind of like piecemeal case by case, like charges against officers who are found having done individual crimes instead of something that exposes, like, basically like a RICO investigation that we're like we're seeing at City Hall. You could absolutely do that in the sheriff's department.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a business maxim that you can't inspect quality into a product, right? And I think that is true as much for the federal investigations or the inspector general's investigations as it is in that arena. It's not the case that removing Jose Huizar from the city council is going to change the way that body operates any more than it would be expected to be the case for our individual sheriff's deputies or for the sheriff himself. I want to say, though, or I guess maybe rephrase my question. Do you think what will come first? Uh-huh. Will Alex Villanueva still be the sheriff? Or do you think that we're going to have federal arrests made after he is gone?
I don't think he's going to be recalled. I think everyone is just kind of, you know, now it's mid 2020. I think now we have basically collectively decided to wait this out. You know, the new election cycle starts he comes up in 22, right?
Yeah.
So I do agree with things you have said that I think it is urgent to get that done. But there is so much going on right now that I don't think there's like the political, like that lift, I don't think is going to happen.
Yeah.
So I actually think indictments could easily come first. Like you have like yeah, especially in the climate of people speaking up about police violence, you have now members of the department willing to come forward and name names. So I think it
right,
maybe couldn't be that long. For LAPD within SWAT, part of the elite metropolitan division, just getting more elite by the day with everything we're hearing. Sergeant Tim Colomi, who was a SWAT supervisor for 11 years until November, filed a lawsuit as a whistleblower saying that he spoke up against what he called they called themselves the SWAT mafia for glamorizing the use of lethal force and for directing the promotions of officers who share those values while maligning the reputations of officers who do not. So basically saying if you prioritize de-escalation instead of killing people, you will be labeled a coward and ostracized by the SWAT mafia and not be promoted. Michael Moore has said that he has not seen the litigation. He's got his emails just like piling. He's just making his way through his emails right now. He's trying to get to inbox zero. He hopes to see this litigation very soon. Mayor Garcetti, for his part, like I was impressed by, he really came out strong against this. He said that he couldn't comment on the specifics of the allegations, but if they were true, they would be troubling. Not that the allegations, okay, didn't go so far as to say that the allegations are troubling right now, but if they are true, then in that case, they would be actually very troubling.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta wait and see, I guess. What do we have to do to get journalists to stop calling the Metropolitan Division elite? What has to happen? What has to be revealed about Metro for it to lose the elite moniker that is seemingly attached to it with the force of God himself?
They used it in the LA Times article about this case. They actually said that they called SWAT the elite unit within the Metropolitan Division. But the word elite is working its way in there at some point. Garcetti also said, I've learned in this job over time to wait to let the professionals who are impartial investigate. And my question is, what taught you that? Like, when did you learn that? What instance like led you to that?
And also, who are they?
Yeah.
Who are those people that he's waiting for?
I mean, I guess it's like the people that have done it for every one of these other investigations where I think civilian complaints are upheld maybe 2% of the time, something like that. Let's
impartiality.
Let's move on. Let's talk about something a little more pleasant. The novel coronavirus. Like it's unbelievable. Every week I can feel it being like a little more normalized. We hit our highest number of cases in one day, more than 4,500, which they said was the result of a backlog, but still a staggering number. And also the highest number of deaths, 91 deaths reported in one day. And the number of deaths has gone up significantly overall. We remain at threat level orange. And
yeah,
the only conclusion that I can come to is that this situation that we are currently in has been deemed acceptable. And the goal is to maintain this level, extremely high, but this level of death and illness, and hope that it doesn't get significantly higher than this. But this is okay.
Garcetti actually referred to this, earlier this past week when he had his press conferences, he actually referred to this as like a moment of hope, something like that, where we had the opportunity to wrest back control. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like the tone from 2 weeks ago where it was very apparent that we had failed, not just communally, but as like a city led by political operatives, we had failed to maintain a hold on the social distancing, the shelter at home, etc. That was gone. This past week, they were talking about how good things were going and how it gave us hope for a continuation of this, like you're saying, flattening the curve at what should be an incredibly and out of question, unacceptably high level.
Yeah, hospitalizations have gone down. That's the one signal that our situation is improving somewhat. That'll, when you have 91 deaths in one day, that'll happen, I assume. Deaths are going up at such a rate. I assume that is having some sort of impact on the number of people who are hospitalized. I imagine it's mostly people who are hospitalized who then die of COVID. But it, you know, after a few weeks of increases, that is a positive sign that people are not being, hospitals aren't filling up as quickly as they are discharging people. Oh, let's talk about this vote in the city council that got a lot of press this week. There was a lot of organizing around it. There was a vote that we talked about with Councilmember Harris Dawson about resuming sweeps, which have very different names depending on who you're talking to. But sweeps, how did you define sweeps, I thought, very well earlier this week, Scott. How did you define them?
So I define sweeps. Emily Alpert Reyes of the LA Times was asking how people think about these, because the subject of the difference between sweeps and services has become so focal in these discussions, particularly among council members. My definition was that it is either the intentional or the effective, either disturbance or disruption of a semi-permanent community cohabitation existing in the public right-of-way by agents of a government authority where they are extracting compliance from people based on the immediate threat of violence or removal.
And so specifically, sweeps have been enforced around these bridge home shelters, this transitional housing that Mayor Garcetti and the city have set up, a few of these like new shelters. And Councilmember Harris Dawson on our show kind of laid out exactly why this program exists. And he said fairly explicitly that this was a trade-off for housed people in the neighborhoods where these shelters went up to say, like, we'll put a shelter here. So, yes, there will be homeless people in your area, but don't worry, we will clean them off the sidewalk. They won't be allowed on the sidewalk near where you live. And where Harris Dawson said, I certainly thought during the interview that he was going to vote to resume the sweeps from how he was talking, because he said, we promised when we put up these shelters, we promised the community that they would we get daily sweeps, he said. And we haven't gotten that. Even right. before the pandemic, we didn't get that. And so now we've got to start keeping up our end of the deal. That's what Joe Buscaino, the council member, said was his argument for putting this forward in the first place. He also said that unhoused people were using their tents outside as second homes from the while they were living in the shelters, and that they're not distancing. Uh-huh. And like, he knows the behavior that they're up to. Councilmember Paul Koretz, this was an amazing moment. Basically, you know, spoke honestly about this at least and said, isn't this intended to move people out of these neighborhoods? Like, you do enough of these sweeps and people will ultimately be forced to leave. And he got pushback from people that were the council members who were against the sweeps and those who were for them, who were, you know, Monica Rodriguez is saying, like, no, this is for their own good. We have to clean the concrete so they don't get coronavirus or whatever. Like, we're doing this for their, say, making them leave for 8 hours a day and then come back and then do it again the next day. The vote passed. They are going to resume the sweeps. It passed 10-4. Council members Bonin, Harris Dawson, Rue, and Wesson voted against resuming the sweeps. Notably, the two like fairly consistent members of the new progressive wing of the council, Bonin and Harris Dawson, and two others, Rue and Wesson, who are up in very close elections against more progressive candidates.
Yeah, the thing I think is I mean, listening to the debate that was had about this motion was at many points infuriating. Councilmember Blumenfield of the 3rd District in the Southwest Valley was, I thought, just flatly offensive in his characterization of what the sweeps entail. You mentioned during our interview with Councilmember Harris Dawson the size of these special enforcement zones that are being sweeped around the Bridge Home shelters and how they often require walks of, you know, a half mile or more just to get someone's belongings out. And Councilmember Blumenfield characterized this as not an onerous policy because it basically amounted to just having to walk down the street and stay there for a couple hours. I've personally been at the site of these sweeps that are done, and it's not that. It is having to figure out a way to get, we managed to move a full encampment's worth of belongings. I was out there with Street Watch with great difficulty, and we had probably 5 or 10 people, in addition to the people who were actually living there, managed to move hundreds of pounds worth of belongings about a half mile away. And the whole time, the residents of the encampment were asking cops, in all earnestness, you know, where can we go and stay here for the entirety of the day? Where can we go that we will not be in legal jeopardy of being arrested or having our belongings seized? And they got no answers. So to suggest that it's just walking to the end of the block and just like cooling your heels for a bit is not accurate. And it is, in my view, representative of the large majority of council, 10 members that we have here voting for this, not understanding what it is that they're voting on. So it was a disappointing vote. That being said, there was also a lot of uncertainty afterward as to what had actually been done. Mayor Garcetti said that the vote did not reauthorize sweeps. Councilmember Buscaino basically said, yes, they did. It was very unclear what had been resolved at this point.
The motion was very vague. Councilmember Bonin, I think at multiple points, said basically, like, what the hell is going on here? What, I don't know what we're doing, what we're voting on. The, I mean, for me, it, what is so sad about this is it's yet another occasion where, like, say this had passed 8-7 or 8-6, then, like, we would be in a position, people that, like, don't, like, understand that sweeps make it more difficult for people to get out of homelessness, are, you know, recommended against by the CDC, like, people that are against these sweeps happening, would be celebrating just maintenance of the current status quo again. Like, yeah, on homelessness, you're just on defense all the time. You never get the ball and, like, really get the opportunity to radically improve people's situations and, like, do something that you feel is actually going to bring down this, just like the fundamental number of people who are homeless, or even, like, improve situations for people that are on the street. You never get that. So yeah, it's like, I mean, understand why people celebrate these other victories, because you have to. Otherwise, you would just, like, how could you even, like, move on?
So, I mean, speaking of which, playing defense, not being able to meaningfully advance the purpose of serving people who are homeless. During this past week, we also had loss of firing yet another employee who apparently ran afoul of political operatives in the city. So this time it was Christy Lovich, who was vocal on social media about the ways in which she viewed Lhasa as falling down in its commitment to unhoused people, but more particularly perhaps had spread an open letter amongst her colleagues in the wake of the late May major protests and demonstrations in Los Angeles, saying that she felt like in order for the agency to be true to its charge within city administration, it should remove its partnerships with the LAPD, LA Sheriff's Department, and other law enforcement organizations. She was this week terminated, basically with no notice, and there hasn't really been comment so far as to why that was done, because they said it was just a personnel matter and they wouldn't speak about it. So this is the second time that's happening. There was a caseworker named Ashley Bennett who was also fired earlier this year during the big battle of Echo Park, the Echo Park encampment that took place in January and February. And according to Ms. Bennett, at least on the direction of Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell, that now this is, I guess, apparently becoming a trend among Lhasa employees. If they say something that is viewed as at odds with the views of the commission that runs it.
That was something that actually Christy Lovich confirmed or said was true in her open letter, that her supervisor had told her that Mitch O'Farrell had ordered the firing of Ashley Bennett. Christy Lovich, I talked about her on the show. She was absolutely instrumental in helping this couple who used to live at Echo Park, who I'd been working with, get into permanent housing. She arranged for them after, like, the day after they had a baby, got them put up in a hotel for weeks before Path could kind of take over their care. Of all the people this couple dealt with, they loved working with her the most. She is so passionate, and so in the same way that Ashley Bennett is, so dedicated to the cause of just, like, improving people's lives who live on the street. That's what led them into the political aspect of this, and that's what got them fired, by all appearances. This is another installment in a long-running story. I'm not sure if this is big enough to actually do the theme song, but, well, let's just do it anyway. Weezer! Indicted by grand jurors. 34 counts. This was, so, like, when people are like, and even I was like, wasn't Huizar already indicted? Like, what's happening? This is again. But that, you explained to me, was a one count complaint that he was indicted for. And now we have added 34 counts. Is that right?
I think it's 34 total.
34 total.
It's, so we have 33. It's a lot of counts.
Yeah.
So Jose Huizar, yes, we haven't caught up with our friend council member Huizar in a moment, and the most recent updates are following the previous complaint, which we talked about on here. He has indicated that he is basically fiscally insolvent and requested and was granted permission to get public defenders to defend him. Indications looking like he intends to go to trial. Mm-hmm. There was a good article by John Rigardi for LA Magazine when the complaint originally was issued, stating that there was at least a possibility that the game by federal officers, by the attorney's office, was to try and impress upon Jose Huizar the magnitude of the charges which could be brought upon him if he did not basically plead guilty, possibly roll up on whoever else was involved that the federal agents did not feel like they had evidence to bring charges to. And apparently that did not work. And now what we're seeing is the full indictment brought, 34 charges, millions of dollars in bribes taken or solicited. The charges are far and away, as you might expect, although the information is basically the same as what was in the complaint, with the added tidbit that Jose Huizar thought maybe he would go be a lobbyist for Carmel Partners, the developer, following the end of his term in office. Most of this is information that we already had, and it really is just reconfiguring it into a lot of charges, by far the largest such case we've seen put to any official, elected or otherwise, thus far. And still, the expectation is that this is not the end of the charges that we will see brought to individuals in this case.
Ray Chan still has not been charged. The former head of the Department of Building and Safety, also a deputy mayor in Los Angeles. George Chang has been pled guilty to charges in this investigation. Ray Chan is George Chang's boss. He is fully implicated in this syndicate. He will be charged. And you just have to wonder why that hasn't happened. They have the goods on him. Like, there's no doubt. So either he's like,
no doubt,
like cooperating to a degree that they just haven't done it yet, or what's going on. But like, yes, to your point, it's not over yet. Here's why Alyssa had to take a vacation. Once again, we had an earthquake in Los Angeles. Alyssa excitedly checks her phone to see if her earthquake or Shake Alert LA app went off, and she just didn't hear it. And it did not. The app that the city of LA created at some expense to provide an early warning system for earthquakes does not work. First of all, Scott, did you feel it?
Yeah, I did. I mentioned on 30 Mile Zone, our movie podcast for Sepulveda Pass holders, our Patreon subscribers, that I was woken up by the earthquake at 4:30 in the morning. I then got out of bed, proceeded to watch a movie, and when it finished, felt the aftershock that happened. Did you feel it?
I did. I woke up and I did manage to go back to sleep, but I fully felt it. It was exciting. It was a perfectly sized earthquake, I feel like.
It was like just long enough so that you could wake up, realize what was happening, and then it ended. Mm-hmm. I think.
And I saw it's the best kind of like carnage photos after the fact, where like I saw a photo of somebody's John Hamm bobblehead that had smashed. But yeah, it does not work. I almost feel like we can't do this justice. So just follow Alyssa's feed. She has been fully losing her shit over this for quite a long time. We don't know this Shake Alert LA app, as she has many times pointed out. We don't know what it would sound like if it did ever go off, which it never has, despite now multiple times the circumstances having occurred where it is supposed to go off. Mayor Garcetti came out and said that it wasn't a strong enough earthquake to set off the alert. That is completely untrue. As Alyssa, I mean, that really set off Alyssa's internal Shake Alert app when he said that. But there is another app. What's the other one? There's one that works that I don't have. I just have the Shake Alert app taking up space on my phone. But there was another one that went off.
Quake Alert.
Quake Alert LA.
Is that really it?
No,
Shake
sorry.
Alert, Quake, LA Alert, Quake Alert.
Quake Alert. Quake Alert USA. Yeah. Like the national Quake Alert app does work. Uses the same data source, by the way, which is the USGS, which apparently did successfully provide the information for the early warning. The LA app just didn't work, but a Quake Alert, which was developed in Santa Monica, did work. So
delete the LA app from your phone.
Who knows what it's doing in there? Who knows what it's up to? Certainly not like interpreting earthquake data of any kind. Karen Bass, boy, another former president of the Community Coalition before Marquise Harris Dawson. But she founded it, actually. It was part of a group that founded it, and I think it was its first leader. She is being considered for the vice president. That sweepstakes that's going on right now and appears to maybe be about to go on for another couple weeks. And the rest of the country, I think, got a taste of something that I'm sure to them was very weird, but here we have kind of gotten used to, which is our elected officials' bizarre, like, tolerance and sometimes embrace of the Church of Scientology. What was it that we saw this week?
Well, so Karen Bass, Representative Karen Bass out of South and West LA here, was, as you mentioned, actually in the media a couple of times. She got a sort of glowing profile in Politico earlier this week about her relationship to Black LA and also her time as the Speaker of the State Assembly. Then she also started getting national press for a less flattering reason, which was that she had spoken favorably of the Church of Scientology and its values about, I want to say, like a decade ago, something like that.
I believe she went to the opening of the like mothership building. Am I wrong about that? Or is that building older? It was the opening of a large Scientology building in LA.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, on the occasion of the opening of a new building, went and spoke about, you know, Scientology's embrace of diversity, et cetera, et cetera. It is something that was put out by a conservative media group. I can't honestly remember which one, maybe Daily Caller, but not really. I don't know. I kind of think about this as something that's not really going to stick that much nationally. Karen Bass, for her part, she came out and said, you know, she explained exactly what was going on in her mind at that point, and said more specifically that if it had been later in the 2010s, after there had been so many documentaries about the aggressive and, you know, so sometimes dangerous methods used by the Church of Scientology, that she wouldn't have said those things, and that her only praises were for commitments to diversity and to the rights of underprivileged communities. I don't know. What do you think, Hayes? This doesn't seem like the sort of thing that, to me, a national Democrat will care that much about. It just doesn't strike me as like there being a ton of meat there to grab onto.
I saw people reacting more strongly than I expected. people acting like being deferential to Scientology meant that she, and even in her denial of it, was like, by the way, I worship at this Baptist church and elsewhere in the city. As if, like, saying, like, I am not a Scientologist.
I'm not a Scientologist.
I don't go to this church. But you can see why, you know, her standing up there in front of the bizarre, like, ornate cornices and stuff of, like, the Scientology church, that people were like, why is she talking about this organization with this, like, level of deference? I mean, this is, like, even, yeah. I mean, you know, by 2010, yeah, we pretty much, like, knew the deal with Scientology.
Sure.
But what people don't understand is elected officials in Los Angeles do this shit all the time. I think it was also Sarah Silverman who posted a photo of standing in front of the big blue church. Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell, whose district has probably 90% of the Scientology real estate in the city, former District 4 Councilmember Tom Labonge, former Assemblymember Mike Gatto, and other elected officials, I believe, participating in some kind of, like, they're all in bike uniforms. They were participating in some kind of, like, Scientology bike ride. They're always giving out the, like, honorifics, the, like, certificates of whatever to the church because their building has been here for 25, 50 years or whatever. It's cozy. LAPD is like, very cozy with them, too. They're one of the biggest landowners in the city. Like, this is kind of par for the course. We should talk about it more. It's incredibly weird. This is an organization that, if you believe all the allegations about it, engages in effectively slave labor and many other very sinister things. But it is part of LA politics. And I do believe kind of the subtext of the story, which is she didn't really know what she was, you know, you just, like, you're told to show up, you're given a sheet of paper and you just read what it says. Like, that's the life of a lot of Congress members. But I don't know.
I mean, I think the my main takeaway from this has not changed considerably from the opinion that I previously held about the vice presidential sweepstakes, as you called it. It is bad and damaging to wage a vice presidential sweepstakes like this, where the contestants are basically black women politicians in this country. Like, somebody was asking me too on Twitter, like, what's the difference between that and the way that the vice presidential pick is normally affected? And I would say the difference is black women occupy a particular space in this country, one that is makes them incredibly vulnerable to abuse and marginalization from basically all corners. I don't think that it is. I mean, if Joe Biden is saying that he is making his choice for vice president and it's going to be a black woman and that it's going to be somebody who is capable of meaningfully contributing to his administration, I would suggest a good first step would be not to cause by sheer negligence a lot of harm to the individual, all of whom by the standards of, you know, liberal Democrat politics are well qualified for the position. There's not really a question. Mm-hmm. All of them, Tammy Duckworth, Kamala Harris, Karen Bass, all individually more than qualified for the job. But as this goes on, I think that what we see as the difference between this and a normal vice presidential shadow contest is that the American public is willing to denigrate black women politicians in ways that it probably wouldn't for other political candidates. So I don't know. It doesn't seem like any good will be achieved by this going on much longer.
Yeah, I think that's true about the willingness to denigrate specifically black women candidates for this position. But also, yeah, I mean, they've been opened up to it so much more purely because the Biden campaign with Mayor Garcetti as co-chair. So this is still local news that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Has made this like paraded them out purely to benefit themselves, to make Joe Biden himself look good. I mean, the alternative is to just pick somebody and not say explicitly, like, we will be picking a woman, and then to move on to this will most likely be a black woman or a woman of color. Like, that's just for self-aggrandizement, and it puts the women themselves in this position to basically fight it out.
Yeah, and, and their respective camps or proponents to do these opposition dumps in the media, that is not, it's not great. It's not going well.
Yeah. There were some protests this week, a protest outside Mayor Garcetti's house today, yesterday, probably other times during the week, led by different groups. Yesterday, I think five people were detained. A couple people were arrested for, the LAPD said, at first battering an officer in one case, but then that was downgraded to resisting arrest. The classic arrested for resisting arrest, something that is literally not possible to do. And there were, what other protests were there?
What did we have? We had last weekend's protests in front of City Hall. Mm-hmm. It's been, I would say it's been a pretty constant stream of protests in downtown and in front of the mayor's house, where he doesn't actually seem to, ever since that last protest where he was seen, it was kind of like the fall of Saigon. He was like getting into his car in the dead of night. I don't think he's been seen at his residence, so unknown if he was actually present or not. But Black Lives Matter did show up bright and early this morning.
Something they caught on video is they were chalking stuff that I'm sure was not nice in front of Garcetti, in front of Getty House, the mayor's mansion. And they had someone from the fire department like spraying it off with a little hose. That's all I think we have to cover this week. That was a lot.
That was a lot. Yeah.
We're looking forward to getting Alyssa back. If you want your dose of Alyssa, subscribe to our Patreon, where we talked about Devil in a Blue Dress on 30 Mile Zone, our show where we talk about every movie in Los Angeles this week. And otherwise, we will be back next week on LA Podcast. Goodbye.